We kick off April with our monthly politics segment on Intersection, and it's a mid-session check on what lawmakers have been doing in Tallahassee. I'm joined by the usual suspects, former Democratic State Representative Dick Batchelor.
Sometimes unusual suspect.
Yeah, he's a member of the Tea Party now, you know.
The decaf Tea Party. Yeah. And, of course, that other voice is former Republican Congressman Lou Fry. Welcome to the show. The big story, of course, and in some ways the only story in Tallahassee, is legislators carving out the state budget. The bottom line, Florida facing a $3.8 billion budget shortfall, and there are going to have to be cuts to services, job eliminations. I want to start off by asking you both, where do you think the biggest difference lies between the two chambers' proposals, the House and the Senate? Start us off, Dick Batchelor.
Well, it looks like they're about a billion and a half dollars apart. And with this, between the House and the Senate, and a lot of the cuts are in the education, and the difference are the education, and also social services are what we call human services. For instance, the House doesn't sufficiently fund community-based programs for mental health, substance abuse, child protection, those types of things. But keep in mind, though, why there are differences. You know, some of them are intentional differences in the way they look at it philosophically. But some of it's all about negotiations. You never go, the House and the Senate never comes out too close, because then you have nothing to give up. So it's all about hardball negotiations at the end. But there are some differences, stark differences, and I would say the question is going to be, are you going to take money away from education and give it social services, or vice versa? Unfortunately, children who are in the public school system and recipients of social services are going to be the two on the chopping block.
Lou Fry, is that how you see it? Education and social services, the biggest difference between the two chambers?
Yeah, and you know, some of these, quote, reforms the governor is talking about are still floating around, like the idea to put a lot of the different trust funds all together under one and then give the governor a lot of increased power to use that money any way that the governor wants to. I'm sort of surprised that that's gone so far, because I thought the legislature would exert a little more power. Frankly, I guess that's the one thing I've been surprised about, Dick, is that they're paying a lot more homage to the governor than I would with his poll numbers. And that is maybe the fact they think they can hide behind him. I mean, they may let him out there, run out there and get shot at, and they can come along and pick up the pieces.
Well, or get political for a moment here. I want to announce that it would not become so obvious. But they need the governor to be stronger. As you go into 2012, you got reapportionment, so you're going to have members running for most of the cases, redrawn House and Senate seats, congressional seats. And at the top of the ticket, you're going to have the governor of the state of Florida. If he's too weak, it's going to go down to others. So the governor needs to be propped up to some extent, if I might use that term.
Well, let's talk about just some of the actual numbers. We're looking at the House Budget Committee recently approving a $66.5 billion budget, the Senate a $69.8 billion budget. They've got to rectify that, about $3 billion difference. You see the House coming in a little bit lower because, like you were talking about trust funds there, Lou, the House wants to take about $704 million out of state trust funding accounts, and including one withdrawing about $300 million from one that's used for road repair. Then you've got the Senate looking at maybe cuts of about $1 billion to programs that would help the elderly, eliminating in the Senate chamber that proposal about 5,000 state worker positions. Which of these do you think is going to grab the public the most, Dick Batchelor?
Well, first of all, maybe tongue-in-cheek, we should never allow any fund of government to be called trust. We shouldn't use the word trust in any government expenditures. But what the legislature is doing is unprecedented. They're basically sweeping all the trust fund monies that were set aside for a very specific purpose, like road building, and they're trying to fatten up a general revenue because of the budget deficit, which is really kind of not a very straightforward and honest way to do it. So you put so now what you've got road builders saying, well, we need these monies in the trust funds to build roads. You're saying the people who want to create jobs, who could create jobs with these monies. So to me, it's borrowing from Peter to pay Paul in an act of Judas, because you really are playing games with trust fund monies. and converting them to general revenue is really very misleading.
Lou Fry, is that a shell game, just moving money from one trust fund to another, in your opinion?
It's been a shell game, but now it's really a big shell game because now you're throwing about everything you can find in it. And why are they doing it? Well, you said we're $3.8 billion short. We're talking about lowering our taxes, corporate tax. We're talking, you know, where are we going to get the money to make up this deficit? And where you're going to get the money is slashing a lot of programs. You know, there's a lot of waste in government. A lot of programs can be looked at. I have no objection to examining programs, see if they can put together something like this. But you're past the meat. You know, you're into the bone, and there's just a lot of people who have incredible needs that are not going to be taken care of.
You talked about cutting taxes. Governor Rick Scott wants to cut about $2.4 billion out of the state's revenue stream by pushing for a significant property tax cut. And we've heard a lot about property tax cuts in recent years. It sounds like neither the House or Senate wants to go that far. Why is it always property taxes, Lou Fry, that come under the microscope when it comes time for big tax cuts in Florida?
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go tax-wise? You know, every 10 years we have a commission that looks into it and comes up with good ideas and that. We don't have any basic tax base except our real property tax and our sales tax. That's it. And unlike a lot of states who have a lot of different taxes, we don't. So when the real estate market falls and that, you have real problems. You just can't print this money. You're going to have to figure a way to come up with it. And the only way you're going to do it is not lower taxes. And cut a lot of programs that I think are going to be really hurt and you hate to cut.
Is there an analogy to someone maybe sitting at home saying, okay, well, I've eliminated my cable bill, I've eliminated my phone bill, my internet bill. Soon you don't have anything else left to cut. You've got to go out and maybe get another job, bring in more revenue.
Right.
Is that ever going to happen? How can Florida bring in more revenue, Dick Batchelor?
700,000 new jobs are coming.
Absolutely. Quickly, we hope. Well, first of all, Lou's absolutely right. If you look at the sales tax collection, that's the big revenue to fund general revenue in the state of Florida. But fortunately, in the state of Florida, it's not as onerous because you don't pay sales tax on food, medicine, utilities, or rent. And that holds it all some. The other side of the spectrum, though, you ask about property taxes, because property taxes, unlike sales taxes, are confiscatory. If you don't buy something, you don't pay the sales tax, you know, that's just your choice. However, if you own a home and you've got property taxes that are due, if you don't pay your property taxes, guess what? They lien your property. You know, if somebody can buy your tax certificates, somebody can buy your home. So property taxes are confiscatory in that if you don't pay them, there are consequences of that. So that's why it's very, very appealing to people, and particularly because the value of the homes, you know, in some parts of the state are going down by 50%. So now they've got something they're paying a mortgage on. They're underwater. Then they got the property tax. The property taxes haven't gone down to meet the depreciation of the value of the home. So that whole property tax thing is a very incendiary issue for the public.
Talk to me a little bit about education cuts here, Dick Batchelor. I know it's something that you're very concerned about. And as we tape this conversation on April Fool's Day, you're going to be heading out to a rally against budget cuts at the state level. We're looking at maybe a 7% cut in per student or public school spending proposed by the House. That means about $463 less on each student. Your thoughts on that, Dick Batchelor?
Well, the fact is, Florida, number one, is about 50 out of 50. We used to say in the good old days, yay for Alabama and Mississippi, they made us look good on a per-student basis as far as the allocation and budgeting. But now we're the lowest in the country. Now you're cutting even more from that. So what are you doing to public education? You're sending a signal that education maybe is not that important. At the same time, we'll give every speech, or we'll give every speech to talk about education is number one, the children are number one, we got to compete in the international global arena, you know, what can we do? But they're not funding public education. And at the same time, they're beating up on the teachers with legislation and that type of thing. So I think public education, K through 12, certainly has been a target of the legislature, and they've almost miniaturized the role of the teachers in this state, which I think is embarrassing.
Lou Fry,
of course,
on that?
This is a state where 40% of the adults can't tell you the three branches of government, where 42% of the people can't explain separation of powers, where 73% of the fourth graders in a national test couldn't pick the Constitution out as a leading legal document. Multiple choice test, and here we are cutting even more. Dick, Senator Graham and I got the legislation passed that starts to teach civics now in first grade. But the problem is that you have 68,000 teachers, very few of whom have ever had a course in civics. And so where are you going to get the money to train them to do the job? So, I mean, education to me is just fundamental. I think that's probably about the last thing that I could cut. And unfortunately, in our state, we export our kids. We don't have the high-tech jobs. And it all comes back to education. If you're going to continue to cut education, is there a 51st state, Dick?
Somebody might be declared one.
Yeah.
But you look at K-12, look at community college, there are probably 35 to 50,000 unfunded FTEs, classroom seats. So you've got the student who's graduating.
Tuition's going up, though, at state universities and colleges, right?
They are, but let me start.
It's under the proposal, right? About a 5% increase?
Look at community colleges first. 35 to 50,000 unfunded FTEs. That means a student who graduates from high school who's qualified to go to community college, either to get a two-year degree, retrain for something, or matriculate from there to a four-year college, cannot get into the classroom. A number of those students will never come back to public education, never come back to be equipped in this marketplace. That, to me, is very, very wrong. And lastly, yes, tuition's going up right now.
Is that a good thing?
Well, not necessarily. First of all, Florida does have the lowest
it
tuition.
It was the lowest state. Tuition.
It was in the state.
Yeah.
And they've allowed to go up 15%. The University of Florida wants to go up 30%. But here's the long-range problem, though. The problem is you can now say, well, it takes a 1,400 SAT and a 4.1 to get in University of Florida. What does that mean? It means a student who makes 3.5, who works very hard, who's a publisher of the newspaper, who gives hundreds of hours community service, who's entitled to a public education, can't get in the classroom. Across the board, you've got to do something about public education. Lou mentioned Bob Graham. He was like the education governor for higher education. And a lot of progress was made, but we're walking backwards now away from it. And again, you can't, as a final point, you can't on one hand give the speech and say public education is important, students are number one, and jobs creation is number one, but you don't equip these people. To me, it's dishonest.
And by the way, in, under Graham and that, the economy grew more because of the emphasis on education, and there was a direct relationship between the money spent and the quality of the education and Florida's economy. And I think that's as true today as it was 20 years ago.
Lou Frey, talk to me a little bit about health care, because that's a big issue that is up in Tallahassee right now. The full House has passed an overhaul for Medicaid patients being put into a kind of private managed care system, be similar to an HMO-style plan. How would this work? What's it going to mean, do you think, and what's the Senate going to do?
Well, the answer to you, no, no, no. I'm not sure what the Senate's going to do. I think it could work. I think this has a chance of working and putting a plan like that together on a private basis and delivering the care is probably worthwhile. Because one of the things we know, health care as it's proposed by the Obama plan is not going to be the same. I mean, whatever was written, it isn't going to be. Who knows where it's going to end up or how it's going to end up. But we're basically working with a clean sheet of paper in what they're doing. And I sort of like this idea, I think. But again, you know, we get these things and you need a little time to look at them and not just react to them.
Dick Batzer, what's your take on this proposal that's moved through the House, changing the way Medicaid patients are handled in Florida?
Well, keep in mind, first, Medicaid is a fast-growing part of every state budget. In Florida, it's now $20 billion a year. That's about 60% of that's federal, 40% state. It's a cost. At the same time, though, they're not doing anything to try to ratchet down the cost of health care. However, going into an HMO or a managed care system, Florida's tried that. We've had three demonstration projects in the state. Marginally successful. And that's why I was concerned about why they would do it all at one time. Why not just expand on some other demonstration projects and test it to see if transferring the Medicaid monies to a managed care system works. You know, don't just radicalize it and just sort of dump it over there and hope it does work, because if it doesn't work, the consequences are some people will be denied health care. We all hope it works. If they go that way, we certainly hope it works. We hope it will reduce costs. But keep in mind, private for-profit managed health care systems have to make a profit in the end. So we'll see where the profit comes from, out of services or out of call savings.
One big picture item I'd like to throw into the mix here. California is facing a budget gap of $25 billion. $25 billion.
I feel better now.
Here in Florida, right, we're looking at almost $4 billion. So should we feel good about the way we're doing? At least we're not facing what California is.
Are you suggesting we exchange governors? I don't know. I don't know what your point is.
As a citizen, I would say that California citizens, there's a lot more ways to tax them and get money out of them out there.
Not apples to apples, then you're saying?
No, I don't think it's apples to apples. So
what you got in Florida, though, in it, under the last 8 years, and primarily the previous 4 years, the legislature, when they had a surplus, they just gave tax breaks left and right. They did away with the intangible tax. They reduced the corporate income tax. So basically about $20 billion. No rainy day fund,
really.
Right, and they had about $20 billion in taxes in 8 years they basically gave away. Those tax revenues now we're in a crisis situation, had they been more prudent, we would have, quote, surpluses in the rainy day fund. We don't have those now, and that's why it's such a difficult time now to balance the budget.
You blame that on the previous legislature, previous governor, then?
Well, I think the fact is that you need to plan, and when you've got income, it's easy to lead when you have money. It's easy to be governor. You can be a very popular governor when you're handing out money. But it would be more prudent to have not given all those tax breaks, to have a larger working capital trust fund, a rainy day fund, so now you could go into that when everything else is depleted. Yeah. So I think it lacked planning.
It's sure they could have tinkered a little with the taxes and with, we were talking, Dick, before about what is covered by your sales tax and that. People for years have said we ought to really look at those exemptions and not just do away with them, but maybe tinker a little bit. And if you got money coming in that, it's a lot easier to tinker on the edges, and that money adds up when you have a bad year or two or three like we're having.
Right.
You're listening to the monthly Intersection Politics segment with Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Fry on WMFE's Intersection. I'm Mark Simpson. Let's get into poll numbers. Rick Scott not doing too well, if we're to believe the poll numbers from public policy polling. You know, they can lead a little left, and of course, Rick Scott very far to the right. So if the numbers are to be believed, only 33% of Florida voters have a favorable opinion of Rick Scott. 43% viewed him negatively. Take that into the Republican category, only 57% approving of his job so far. 27% of Republicans in Florida disapproving. And maybe the biggest, most interesting thing showing, in a hypothetical rematch between Alex Sink and Rick Scott, Alex Sink comes out ahead 56% to 37% for Scott. So, Lou Fry, what do we learn about Governor Scott from this?
Well, Governor Scott says you've got to run the state of Florida like a business. And a number of us who've been in this for a number of years have said a state is not a business. There's good business principles that can be applied, but you've got three branches of government that you have to do. You just can't say do something and get it done. You have to be willing to work with other people. You have to be able to compromise. And so far, the governor doesn't seem to be able to do that. If he asked me what to do, I'd say, look, get some people together. Get Jim Smith together. Get Lou Fry. Get some people who have been around and don't have an axe in the thing and figure out how to be the governor and what you have to do. And you can't ignore the legislature, even if it's not very powerful. This legislature is powerful because it's got the ability to override anything that the governor does. And so the power really rests there. Legislators do not like to be embarrassed. They don't like to read that their train project has been shut down, number one. And secondly, they sure as heck hate to read about it in the paper and not know about it before. So when you look at those numbers, I think they're very realistic numbers. And the problem comes when you get like that, people start to move away from you. They are not afraid of the power necessary. They see blood in the water. And there's one thing in politics where there's blood in the water, boy, you know, look out, because your best friends will come and eat you alive. And it'll be very interesting to me at this point to see what influence the governor is going to have in the legislative session, and also if that influence is going to be a positive thing on the governor himself, because he could maybe have some influence, but it may make it even worse than it is. And government is different than running a business.
Let me just set some context for our listeners, talking about lawmakers finding out about the high-speed rail there in the paper. I think you're talking about Speaker of the House Dean Cannon said he wasn't even aware of it until he read it in the paper.
Yeah.
Dick Batchelor, this has got to be a bitter pill to swallow to see the results that
I'm trying.
Your candidate, Alex Sink,
can you see those tears? You have a tall.
Would have come out ahead in this hypothetical rematch. What do you see here in the numbers?
Well, first of all, you go back and remember that this candidate spent $76 million of his own money, and that certainly made a tremendous difference in the election. He led with some issues that, frankly, are not going to come to fruition, promising 700,000 new jobs. He should be czar if he's able to do that. he's really shown that he's really not, in my opinion, a leader at this point in time. It would be interesting to see how the legislature ends, what he's willing to veto, what they're willing to override. But I don't think he's been strong, and I think he's weak. And unless he does something drastic, he's going to remain weak.
Let's talk about where we're standing here in the legislative session, because as I understand, we've got bills being signed already by the governor, both chambers moving swiftly on their budgets. A lot of observers in Tallahassee saying we're at least a week ahead of schedule for the legislature. And I read recently that, you know, if the lawmakers do pass their budget early, they could send it to the governor, trigger off the one-week rule, which means that that is the amount of time the governor has to sign off on it. Maybe you could see lawmakers coming back, overriding vetoes if they didn't like it with the governor. Is this going to happen, do you think? Are we on the fast track, Dick Batchelor?
On a very fast track, and I think it's intentional to do that, too. And I think you have to when you do things like this, and that are, some would say radical, some would say progressive, some would say just new. And you need to move fast. You know, you've got, it's all about, you know, power abhors a vacuum. And if you've got the leadership, you better get it done. And there's no opposition. Democrats have a very small minority in the House.
Republicans have a supermajority.
Super. In fact, I said this morning, I'll probably have to apologize to someone at the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party or the Democratic members of the legislature have become like speed bumps. I mean, they're not barricading anything, but they're kind of trying to slow stuff down, but not very effectively because they just don't have the numbers to do that. But it would be very interesting if they give the governor a budget early, and that's going to be a real test of wills to see if the governor works with the legislature now and agrees with the legislature on what they're going to forward to him as a budget beforehand. That would be a very smart move. If they send him a budget he does not like, or if he wants a grandstand, keep in mind he went over to a Tea Party rally in Lake County at a Baptist church, unveiled his budget. He didn't go to Tallahassee and meet with the House and Senate members. If he wants to try to be Mr. Maverick and independent, I think his staff, which is not a very seasoned staff, no institutional knowledge, might suggest, well, veto four or five things and you'll get some good press. But be careful what you hope for, because as Lou pointed out, the House and Senate have their veto proof. They can override anything he vetoes.
You know, there's another thing floating around. I don't think there's a governor of a state, and especially a major state, that doesn't think that he or she should be a candidate for the presidency or the vice presidency. And so here you are in the third largest state in the country. You've got a budget out there that's a question. Maybe it's a little bit over. What a great way to get national publicity is to stand up there and veto that and say you're standing for the budget. You know, you're going to get this thing back, and you don't care what it is personally and what the polls do, but you're going to do that, and you'll be the darling of the Tea Party across the country, or some legitimately some conservatives. So don't ever forget that. In politics, things don't there aren't coincidences. Things usually happen, good or bad, in terms of reasoning, but there's usually a pattern you can find after a period of time.
Dick Batchelor, a procedure question for you. If the lawmakers do hand in the budget early, would they stay in session and finish out the full 2 months there, or would they go home early, do you think, and come back in a special session?
I think Senator Herod Dopless, who's the Senate president, who's a candidate for the United States Senate, would love to have on his resume that he completed the legislature the earliest of any time. So I would think they would take some of the bills that aren't very controversial, put them on the consent agenda, try to pass those. But I think their goal would be to get out of town. It's a very demonstrative thing when you say we finish 1 week early.
And they're only required to pass the budget. They're not required to actually stay the full 90 days.
No, right? They can actually leave and then come back.
Yeah. There's a couple candidates that are looking like they're mounting up runs or actually dismounting from runs. You're talking about George Lemieux, talking about Connie Mack, and maybe Jeb Bush there. Throw it to us, Lou Fry.
Well, when somebody who looks like they got a shot at running doesn't run, that there's reasons for it, again, going back to it. And Connie Mack certainly has got a great name. He was in a good position to run. He was in a good part of the state with a lot of Republicans over there. Most people thought he was going to run. So the first thing you say to yourself, well, Bill Nelson is vulnerable, but maybe not as vulnerable as everybody thought, according to the polls right now.
No one in a poll. He didn't base his decision on the poll. You're kidding me.
No. Oh, no. Not at all. So Nelson's sitting there with the ability to raise money and the fact that maybe he's stronger than people thought. Secondly, it's going to take an awful lot of money. It's going to take millions and millions of dollars, and do you want to do that? Third, is there something sitting there that, you know, could be a problem Nobody, you know, you never know in these kind of things, but looking at the thing, you got to really make sure there is no problem in something like that. So I think it was very significant that, Connie did not run. If I was Nelson, I would be somewhat cheered by it. I also think that you'll probably end up with about seven or eight Republicans who are going to jump in this thing. I mean, there's people like Cliff Stearns, who's been in Congress a number of years, who's interested in it. People talked about Andrew Crenshaw, the new congressman, the African-American congressman from the Southeast, Vern Buchanan. I'm just throwing out names that a lot of people don't know, but these
George Lemieux, one of
George
those names.
George Lemieux, yeah. Can he survive Connie? Can he survive Charlie Crist? You know,
you think we're going to see Charlie Crist coming around for this?
No, but he's his buddy and everything, and he's tied in with him. And, you know, can he do that? So, you know, I sort of feel about like the outside of the Senate thing, if you will. It's sort of like my bracket in the NCAAs for those of you who want to bet illegally. I don't have a lot of winners. So far, the Republican field is just starting to unfold.
Dick Batchelor, your take on these stirrings of candidates looking to challenge U.S. Senator Bill Nelson?
The more stirring amongst the Republicans, the better for Democrats. We like them when they stir and actually fight. The one thing about Connie Mack, you know, is, of course, for maybe some new listeners, his father was a former United States Senator by the same name, Connie Mack. And keep in mind, though, he's married to Congresswoman Mary Bono, Sonny Bono's widow.
From California.
Lives in California. So you're in the southwest part of the state of Florida. You've got a bride or a wife who's in California. I'm sure it had to pay, you know, they have children. And I'm sure that played some role in that. But I think Connie Mack, as a Democrat, him not running was a good sign for us because, as Lou said, you've got other people, including the Senate President Herodopoulos. But the problem that a lot of politicians make, they think because they're known in their district, they're known throughout the state, or they think because they're in Tallahassee, the Senate President Speaker, that people know their names.
That's happened time and time again.
They do not. And the people don't know them. And when you're no longer Senate President, unless you've raised several million dollars, then you're going to be in line with everybody else who wants to be a candidate.
Talk to me about new census numbers that came out. This, of course, going to affect some new seats for the state of Florida. Do we know where those are going to happen and who's going to be up for them?
No, but my guess is you're going to have one in the southeast part and one somewhere in central Florida. And that's why when Dick was talking before about the fact that Mike Herodopoulos is Senate president, wants to run for the U.S. Senate, I would not be shocked that Dean Cannon, a lot of people would like to run for the congressional seat if it's around here. I mean, Tom Feeney built himself a wonderful seat as Speaker of the House. He had a problem, but otherwise he'd have still been there. And I think you can probably get another good Republican seat out of this general area and that. Not that politics enters into reapportionment. It's all going to be done fairly with no worry about how the districts look or anything.
So you're
like that.
Saying there will be fair districts?
Fair districts. Yeah. If you're the Speaker of the House, yeah.
Right. Now the difference now though is Amendment 5 and Amendment 6 passed, and unfortunately, Dean Cannon, the Speaker of the House, is using our tax dollars to fight it, even though the public voted to amend the Constitution by 63%, which to me is an unreasonable position for him to take. But at least if that stands, that you're going to have guidelines. You know, compactness, contiguous districts. You can't draw a district.
Brown is dead then, Dick.
Huh?
Kareem Brown.
Will be, and that's a good point,
too.
If you look at Orange County, you know, John Mica's district runs from just the northern part, a small bit of Cimarron County, all the way to Jacksonville. Congresswoman Corinne Brown, who represents a lot of Orange County.
Up and down
County,
the coast.
All the way to Jacksonville, yeah. Which makes no sense. And now she's on the other side of the litigation. She wants to preserve that. But I think if Amendment 5 and 6 stand, give them guidelines to reapportionment. You know, I think there's going to be a compact district.
I think there will, but I still think it's going to be highly politicized. And if the Republicans are going to do everything they can to get as many Republican districts, I mean, this is not new. This goes way, way, way back. And I don't care what you pass as an amendment, you can have eight popes there or nine, and you're not going to take the politics out of it. Each party is going to try to take advantage of what they can to get the best deal.
You're suggesting something that Pope wants to be seen with legislators. Now.
Well, who knows these days?
All right, final words there from Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House Representative, now heading the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Lou Fry, former Republican Member of Congress, now with Lowndes, Drostek, Doster, Kanner, and Reed. Thank you, Lou.
Always a pleasure.
Guys, we will catch you on the next round.